You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Brookings Institution Governance Studies Program. I'm Norman Eisen. I'm a fellow here at Brookings, and I'm joined by my frequent colleague and writing partner, Professor Richard Painter at the University of Minnesota Law School. Professor Painter, of course, was President Bush's ethics advisor, and I had the honor to serve in that same capacity for President Barack Obama. And one of the great pleasures of being an ex-ethics advisor is getting to work in a bipartisan way with your colleagues. We have a tradition in the field of ethics of nonpartisanship, and that's why some have been surprised, I know, this week to hear me say that Rex Tillerson has done his ethics agreement and his disclosures and making a clean break from his business of Exxon in a very definitive way. And we've had others were surprised when, and Richard has taken a similar view, he'll say a word, or others may have been surprised when Richard and I said that reasonable people can disagree about anti-nepotism. We take one view, a tough view, but we recognize there's a debate. We even wrote in the New York Times that we acknowledge the debate about the application of the anti-nepotism law to Jared Kushner, and we said that Mr. Kushner had made a good first step, again, in making a commitment. In principle, we have to see the details. Proof of the pudding is in the eating. But he's made a principled commitment to make that same clean break, including the use of a blind trust. So these standards are very, very important to us, and we're going to introduce to you today, we've had the honor to add to our press availability, which was to reflect on the events of the day, and our shared disappointment that Richard and I have articulated in our joint bipartisan statement that President Trump did not follow the example of his nominees and of every president for the past four decades in using a blind trust arrangement or the equivalent to cleanly sever himself from his business interest, to recognize the conflicts of interest that might result. And in President-elect Trump's case, it's even a more problematic situation because he's receiving foreign government payments and other benefits, things of value, that's expressly prohibited by the Constitution of the United States, the so-called Foreign Emoluments Clause. So it was very disappointing to us. Richard and I will reflect more upon that later. I'm going to let Richard say a very quick word, coming to us live by the miracle of technology. He's a much better ethics authority than I am. That's why he's larger. Richard is going to say a very quick word as well, by way of introducing our OGE director, Walt Schaub. Richard, I'll stay at the podium, and then I'll call Director Schaub up.
Well, thank you, Norm. I have worked in government ethics since I was with the White House in 2005 to 2007 as the chief White House ethics lawyer. And I worked on corporate ethics and lawyers' ethics for years before that. And the one thing I want to say from the beginning here is that ethics in the executive branch has for decades been monitored very closely and effectively by the Office of Government Ethics. OGE has worked with administrations, both Republican and Democrat, to assure that executive branch officials comply with the criminal conflict of interest statutes and the other ethics rules. Walter Schaub, who's now the director of the Office of Government Ethics, was very helpful to the Bush administration in working with us on financial disclosure forms and on ethics agreements, making sure that executive branch officials did not violate the laws or even create an appearance of violating the laws. OGE is a very, very important independent agency for the executive branch, just as the Office of Congressional Ethics is for the legislative branch. And I am very upset to hear that within 10 days of the members of House of Representatives seeking to abolish the Office of Congressional Ethics, we see super PACs, which have, of course, their own ethical problems, but super PACs running ads attacking the Office of Government Ethics and the director of the Office of Government Ethics. And this is shocking to me. I've never seen it happen before. And I hope that President-elect Trump, soon to become President Trump, refuses to support public attacks on the Office of Government Ethics or its director, Mr. Schaub. We are not going to, in this country, tolerate the dismantling of independent ethics agencies. We're not going to have any Saturday night massacres over at the Office of Government Ethics. And if that kind of thing goes on, I'm going to make it very, very clear that that's exactly when it's time for the House of Representatives to swing into action. This is an ethics in government, not just for the president, but all of the nominees to the executive branch and all the officials in the executive branch. It's critically important. And we can go through President Trump's proposed plan with respect to his business enterprises and where it could be improved, and it definitely has to be improved upon. But I want to just emphasize from the outset that none of this is important. None of this will be relevant if we do not maintain independent ethics oversight in both the legislative and the executive branch. And those who are attacking the Office of Congressional Ethics or the Office of Government Ethics should be ashamed of themselves and have no place in our democracy.
Walter Schaub, I will add to what Richard said that when I had the privilege of working on these issues in the Obama transition, the same nonpartisan approach, even though the then director of OGE, Rick Cusick, was a Republican nominee, appointee, confirmed by President Bush, all the staff, whatever their political affiliation may have been, everybody worked in a thoroughly professional, bipartisan way. And because we wanted to get to the right answer, as was the case with Mr. Tillerson, or in midstream now with Mr. Kushner, because we wanted to get to the right answer, we put party aside. Ethics knows no partisanship, and there's no greater champion that I know of that principle of fairness, of defending ethics, of trying to do the right thing, and of trying to serve the public in a totally nonpartisan way than OGE Director Walter Schaub. I'm going to welcome the director to the podium. It's a very busy day for ethicists today, and he's got a lot of nominees that he's working through. So he's going to give us some remarks and then head back to OGE. Richard and I will stay behind to take questions about today's events. Director Schaub? Thank you. Thanks for being here. There's a glass of water for you under the podium.
Okay. I wish circumstances were different, and I didn't feel the need to make public remarks today. You don't hear about ethics when things are going well. You've been hearing a lot about ethics lately. I need to talk about ethics today because the plan the president has announced doesn't meet the standards that the best of his nominees are meeting and that every president in the past four decades has met. My hope is that if the Office of Government Ethics can provide some constructive feedback on his plan, he may choose to make adjustments that will help him resolve his conflicts of interest. I'll limit my remarks today and won't be talking about nominees whose ethics packages haven't gone to the Senate. With that limitation, there's still much I can say. For starters, I'm happy to report that it's not all bad news. OGE has been able to do good work during this presidential transition. I'm especially proud of the ethics agreement we developed for the intended nominee for Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson. Mr. Tillerson's making a clean break from Exxon. He's also forfeiting bonus payments worth millions. As a result of OGE's work, he's now free of financial conflicts of interest. His ethics agreement serves as a sterling model for what we'd like to see with other nominees. He clearly recognizes that public service sometimes comes at a cost. The greater the authority entrusted in a government official, the greater the potential for conflicts of interest. That's why the cost is often greater as you go higher up. We've had similar success with some of the president-elect's other nominees. Some of them haven't quite gotten there yet, as I've pointed out in recent letters to the Senate, but with an example like Mr. Tillerson's ethics agreement, I anticipate we'll get them there too. In connection with this work, it's important to recognize that OGE is not the enforcement mechanism, but the prevention mechanism. OGE is nonpartisan and does its work independently. Our goal, our reason for existing, is to guard the executive branch against conflicts of interest. We can't risk creating the perception that government leaders would use their official positions for personal profit. That's why I was glad in November when the president-elect tweeted that he wanted to, as he put it, in no way have a conflict of interest with his businesses. Unfortunately, his current plan can't achieve that goal. It's easy to see that the current plan does not achieve anything like the clean break Rex Tillerson is making from Exxon. Stepping back from running his positions is meaningless from a conflicts of interest perspective. The presidency is a full-time job, and he would have had to step back anyway. The idea of setting up a trust to hold his operating businesses adds nothing to the equation. This is not a blind trust. It's not even close. I think Politico called this a half-blind trust, but it's not even halfway blind. The only thing it has in common with a blind trust is the label, trust. His sons are still running the business, and of course he knows what he owns. His own attorney said today that he can't unknow that he owns Trump Tower. The same is true of his other holdings. The idea of limiting direct communication about the business is wholly inadequate. That's not how a blind trust works. There's not supposed to be any information at all. Here, too, his attorney said something important today. She said he'll know about a deal if he reads it in the paper or sees it on TV. That wouldn't happen with a blind trust. In addition, the notion that there won't be new deals doesn't solve the problem of all the existing deals and businesses. The enormous stack of documents on the stage when he spoke shows just how many deals and businesses there are. I was especially troubled by the statement that the incoming administration is going to demand that OGE approve a diversified portfolio of assets. No one's talked to us about this, and there's no legal mechanism to do that. Instead, Congress set up OGE's blind trust program under the Ethics in Government Act. Under that law, anyone who wants a blind trust has to work with OGE from the start, but OGE has been left out of this process. We would have told them that this arrangement fails to meet the statutory standards. The president-elect's attorney justified the decision not to use a blind trust by saying that you can't put operating businesses in a blind trust. Well, she's right about that. That's why the decision to set up this strange new kind of trust is so perplexing. The attorney said she also feared the public might question the legitimacy of the sale price if he divested assets. I wish she had spoken to those of us in government who do this for a living. We would have reassured her that presidential nominees in every administration agree to sell illiquid assets all the time. Unlike the president, they have to run the gauntlet of a rigorous Senate confirmation process where the legitimacy of their divestiture plans can be closely scrutinized. These individuals get through their nomination process by carefully ensuring that the valuation of their companies is done according to accepted industry standard. There's nothing unusual about that. For these reasons, the plan does not comport with the tradition of our presidents over the past 40 years. This isn't the way the presidency has worked since Congress passed the Ethics in Government Act in 1978 in the immediate aftermath of the Watergate scandal. Since then, Presidents Jimmy Carter, Ronald Reagan, George H.W. Bush, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, and Barack Obama all either established blind trusts or limited their investments to non-conflicting assets like diversified mutual funds, which are exempt under the conflict of interest law. Now, before anyone's too critical of the plan the president-elect announced, let's all remember there's still time to build on that plan and come up with something that will resolve his conflicts of interest. In developing the current plan, the president-elect didn't have the benefit of OGE's guidance. So to be clear, OGE's primary recommendation is that he divest his conflicting assets. Nothing short of divestiture will resolve these conflicts. This has been my position from the start. The media covered some messages I sent the president-elect through Twitter. While some people got what I was doing, I think some others may have missed the point. I was trying to use the vernacular of the president-elect's favorite social media platform to encourage him to divest. My thinking was that more pointed language would have been too strong at a point in time when he was still trying to make up his mind. I reiterated my view in written response to questions from the Senate, which is posted on OGE's website. And I've been pursuing this issue because the ethics program starts at the top. The signals a president sends sets a tone across the executive branch. A tone from the top matters. I've had the honor and great privilege of serving as the director of the Office of Government Ethics for 4 years now, but I've been in the ethics program for much longer than that, having come up through the ranks as a career government ethics official. Over the years, I've worked closely with countless officials and administrations of both major political parties. Ethics has no party. The job hasn't always been easy, though, especially when I've had to ask nominees and appointees to take painful steps to avoid conflicts of interest. I can't count the number of times I've had to deliver the bad news that they needed to divest assets, break open trusts, and dissolve businesses. Most of these individuals have worked with us in good faith. Their basic patriotism usually prevails as they agree to set aside their personal interests to serve their country's interests. Sometimes these individuals have required more persuasion, but every OGE director has been buoyed by the unwavering example of presidents who resolve their own conflicts of interest. As I said, every president in modern times has taken the strong medicine of divestiture. This means OGE directors could always point to the president as a model. They could also always rely on the president's implicit assurance of support if anyone balked at doing what OGE asked them to do. Officials in any administration need their president to show ethics matters, not only through words, but through deeds. This is vitally important if we're going to have any kind of ethics program. Now, some have said that the president can't have a conflict of interest, but that's quite obviously not true. I think the most charitable way to understand such statements is that they are referring to a particular conflict of interest law that doesn't apply to the president. That law, 18 U.S.C. 208, bars federal employees from participating in particular matters affecting their financial interests. Employees comply with that law by recusing, which is a lawyerly way of saying they have to stay out of things affecting their financial interests. If they can't stay out of these things, they have to sell off their assets or get a waiver. That's what presidential appointees do. But Congress understood that a president can't recuse without depriving the American people of the services of their leader. That's the reason why the law doesn't apply to the president. Common sense dictates that a president can, of course, have a very real conflicts of interest. A conflict of interest is anything that creates an incentive to put your own interests before the interests of the people you serve. The Supreme Court has written that a conflict of interest is, and I'm quoting here, an evil which endangers the very fabric of democratic society, for democracy is effective only if the people have faith in those who govern, and that faith is bound to be shattered when high officials and their appointees engage in activities which arouse suspicions of corruption. That same court referred to what it called a moral principle underlying concerns about conflicts of interest. The court cited, and I'm quoting again, the biblical admonition that no man may serve two masters, a maxim which is especially pertinent if one of the masters happens to be economic self-interest. A president is no more immune to the influence of two masters than any subordinate official. In fact, our common experience of human affairs suggests that the potential for corruption only grows with the increase of power. For this reason, it's been the consistent policy of the executive branch that the president should act as though the financial conflict of interest applied. One of my tweets in my letter to Congress cited an OGE opinion issued during the Reagan administration that articulated this very policy. Back when he was working for the Department of Justice, the late Antonin Scalia also wrote an opinion declaring that a president should avoid engaging in conduct prohibited by the government's ethics regulations, even if they don't apply. Justice Scalia warned us that there would be consequences if a president ever failed to adhere to the same standards that apply to lower-level officials. The sheer obviousness of Scalia's words become apparent if you just ask yourself one question. Should a president hold himself to a lower standard than his own appointees? I appreciate that divestiture can be costly, but the president-elect would not be alone in making that sacrifice. I've been involved in just about every presidential nomination in the past 10 years. I've also been involved in the ethics review of presidents, vice presidents, and most top White House officials. I've seen the sacrifices these individuals have had to make. It's important to understand that the president is now entering a world of public service. He's going to be asking his own appointees to make sacrifices. He's going to be asking our men and women in uniform to risk their lives in conflicts around the world. So no, I don't think divestiture is too high a price to pay to be the president of the United States of America. As we all know, one of the great things about America is its system for preventing public corruption. For a long time now, OGE has helped developing countries set up their own systems for detecting and preventing conflicts of interest. Our executive branch program is considered the gold standard internationally and has served as a model for the world. But that program starts with the office of the president. The president-elect must show those in government and those coming into government after his inauguration that ethics matters. All of this is to say there are reasons why experts and others are expressing concern. These calls for divestiture have been bipartisan. You have the example of President Obama's ethics counsel, Norm Eisen, and President Bush's ethics counsel, Richard Painter, both who I've had the privilege of working with. The conservative Wall Street Journal recommended divestiture, so did conservative columnist Peggy Noonan. It's plain to see that none of this reflects any partisan motivation. All you have to do is imagine what will happen if the president-elect accepts this advice and divests. He'll be stronger. He'll have a better chance of succeeding. So will the ethics program and the government as a whole. And in turn, so will America. We should all want that. I want that. In closing, I'd just like to add that I'm happy to offer my assistance and the assistance of my staff if he decides to adjust his plan. Thank you.
Richard, you're back. We're happy to take any questions that anyone may have. Professor Kmark?
Can you explain in a little bit more detail the presidential exception that that Trump's lawyer kept referring to this morning, and I know the OGE director went through that quickly, but for the non-lawyers in the room, can you just play that out a little?
Even for the lawyers in the room, the details of the ethics laws can be intricate. There is a long-running debate, and by the way, it's not a resolved debate, about the scope of a doctrine in American law known as the separation of powers. And what that means is that the president can't, the executive branch, can't meddle in the affairs of the legislative branch of the Congress, and neither of them can meddle in the affairs of the courts. Everybody has their own co-equal realm. The hard question of presidential ethics that arises out of this separation of powers is whether Congress can tell the president that he is forced as a condition of doing his job to divest his assets or not. There are some scholars who believe that it was appropriate. And there was a debate that was resolved in the Bush administration by the Congress exempting the president and the vice president. It's closed as a matter of legislation at the moment. It's not closed as a matter of law. And there are other ways that you could frame this that do not condition. For example, that do not invade separation of powers. There can be no dispute that the Emoluments Clause is in the Constitution. So an Emoluments Clause violation cannot be a separation of powers violation. So if you based a divestiture requirement on the emoluments clause, and that, by the way, would not just hit foreign assets. It would hit domestic assets, too. So Trump's hotel here in D.C., foreign customers. So I think there's a broader debate that is now going to be reopened. I don't believe Congress is going to allow these emoluments to flow unchecked. Sooner or later, you're already seeing efforts, more than 20 Democratic co-sponsors, to impose some restrictions based on the emoluments clause, and I think you're going to see more.
Let me add to this that the emoluments clause is one of several provisions of the law that apply to the president. The president is not above the law. We have had at least one president who believed he was above the law, and that created a constitutional crisis in the early 1970s. We do not want to go back to that again. The Emoluments Clause applies to the president. It is rooted in the concern of the founders of this country that foreign governments would try to meddle in American politics and win through payments to United States government officials that which they could not win through force of arms, which was the domination of the Americas by foreign powers. And what's the point of having the Tea Party and throwing King George's tea into Boston Harbor if you're then going to elect a president who's buying and selling tea with King George or any other foreign power? Or the Russians are. This is not an obscure provision of the Constitution. No one holding a position of trust in the United States government can be receiving profits from dealing with foreign governments. Emolumentum, Latin root, profiting. It's clear that any of the profits earned by the Trump Organization or any other business enterprise owned by any United States government official from dealing with foreign governments are constitutionally prohibited. And then we also have the bribery and gratuity statutes, and laws against bribery have existed for centuries. And those also apply to the president. And if he owns a business and someone is talking about United States government business and Trump Organization business side by side, you're going to have a situation where there's going to be an investigation of at least an allegation and an investigation of a violation of the bribery laws, a solicitation of a bribe. We already have lobbyists who are trying to rent rooms in the Trump Hotel in Pennsylvania Avenue. I hear the college athletic directors want to do this, and then invite the president to attend and get the White House staff in there and use that as a draw to get the Department of Education in there. Well, here you have people paying money to the president side by side with lobbying the White House and the rest of the executive branch. Now, that's starting to look like a quid pro quo to me. That's not the kind of thing that ought to be going on, and I think he's going to need to get rid of that hotel. It's a lot more problems, but there are a lot more problems with that hotel than just that GSA lease. It's going to be a real headache for the president for the next 4 years if he doesn't get rid of it.
We're getting some feedback there. Great. One of the very important questions about the hotel is, will the president's daughter, Ivanka Trump, remain involved in the hotel? And if so, if her husband, Mr. Kushner, enters the government, what imputed conflicts will apply? Because the conflicts laws, of course, apply to spouses. We need more details to understand that and other questions. I neglected to mention that you can also ask questions, because I know we have a large audience on the internet, including many of our friends in the Fourth Estate, who are some of them here. We're tapping away, filing their stories today from the audience, and others who are watching at their desks as they file. So you can tweet questions, as always, when we do these events here at Brookings. You can tweet questions to me at Norm Eisen on Twitter. N-O-R-M-E-I-S-E-N, I'm going to take some of those as we go. But first, I'm going to ask if there's anything else in the audience that anybody wants to ask. John Hudak.
Norm, the president-elect said today that he would donate all the profits from Trump hotels as president in an effort to avoid a violation of the Emoluments Clause. Can you explain whether that is a way around the Emoluments Clause? And if so, or perhaps if not, how would an administration actually go about monitoring that? Would they have to appoint an arbitrator to monitor it in order to make sure that all of the profits are actually donated to the United States Treasury?
Thanks for that good question, John. It is not my view, nor the view of any of the bipartisan experts who've spoken out today, that the announced Trump plan is sufficient to cure his emoluments problem. Even if it were possible to peel out the profits only from the hotel, the emoluments clause is not written to say that all emoluments are permitted except for Trump hotel profits. It's a terrible a mix of things that exist that constitute emoluments in a complex national international business. Putting the hotels to the side, how are we going to decide what is and is not a profit? Are you going to question everybody who comes to the hotel? Make them take a lie detector test? If they're a foreign government official, are they going to submit the bill back to the foreign governments? What about the non-hotel properties, the condos and apartments he sells, the other businesses he does around the world? What about the non-cash emoluments? He has two businesses that are very important, two main business lines, Donald Trump. One is his real estate, which relies on the permitting process. Permits are emoluments. Think of emoluments as benefits of value of any kind. And the other is trademarks, his licensing business. It's my view, trademarks are emoluments as well. And indeed, he's filed for trademark protections, dozens and dozens reportedly of foreign trademark protections since the presidential campaign started. So I don't think, and nobody seems to think, other than his lawyer, that this cures the emoluments issue. Larry Tribe, America's most prominent constitutional scholar, who Professor Painter and I were honored to co-author our Brookings paper on the Emoluments Clause with, has detailed today, I wouldn't think it was possible to write a new chapter in a constitutional treatise on Twitter. Larry Tribe has done it today, explaining why this hotel profit scheme, even if you could tease out elements, why it just doesn't measure up. And speaking of Twitter, I'm not rudely checking my email, but instead looking to see what these questions are. Richard, can I throw one of the Twitter? We're running a little short on time, so can I throw another one of the Twitter questions to you? Would that be okay?
Well, all right. I would talk about the hotel, but the emoluments has got to talk about a lot more in the hotel, and I'll reserve judgment on the hotel arrangement because there are a lot of other emoluments in this Trump business empire they haven't talked about. So there's no point talking about the hotel and whether that works or not until they address the other emoluments, like the loans from the foreign government-owned banks and the rent and the rest of it.
All right, I'm gonna take one of the Twitter questions, which are pouring in, and I'm going to ask the AP if they wanted to ask a question.
Yeah, just briefly. There's been a lot of
concentration. Hold on 1 second, Steve. Liz is getting you the mic. Okay, because we've got our internet audience, which we're very glad for.
All right, Steve Braun, I'm with AP. There's been a lot of focus, obviously, on the impact on the president-elect. My question is about the Trump Organization and its sundry companies. Are they in potential legal jeopardy at all going forward from the plan that was outlined this morning?
Richard Painter, are the Trump companies and enterprises facing any legal jeopardy as a result of the plan announced today?
Well, if they are owned by President Trump, they are going to be very attractive targets for litigation by plaintiff's lawyers, who would be thrilled to once again get a president under oath in a deposition. We've been there, done that, and it didn't turn out so well for President Clinton. And so we're going to have a lot of plaintiffs' lawsuits going on. We also have exposure to criminal investigations under the bribery gratuity statute. If people start mixing Trump business with the United States government business, for example, leasing out the space in the hotels, the lobbyists trying to lobby the White House. So there are a whole host of legal problems for the Trump business organization. I want to emphasize, though, there's a national security element here that's critically important. We have the Trump name up on buildings all over the world. This poses a risk to the lives of the people who are working in those buildings. When you put the president's name on a building, and then on top of that, people are making insulting comments about other people's religion, that just makes it even worse. And I've seen no proposals to deal with that risk, no proposals for who's going to pay for the security. We also don't know who the president-elect's business partners are. Are they Russian oligarchs? Are they Americans? We don't know who the other investors are. We don't know where the debt is in this portfolio because it's not disclosed. So there are a whole range of different problems for these business organizations. I'm going to have to go in a minute or two because I have to make another appearance. I believe with you, Norm, but I have to drive.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're going to end at 4:45. I just wanted to see if the New York Times wanted to ask anything. Eric Lipton.
Yeah, thank you. What power does OGE have, if any, to try to enforce his opinion? And what recourse is there if the president-elect simply says, I don't care?
Well, I'm reminded of one of the seminal moments in American legal history, and because of the influence of our Constitution on the rest of the world, one of the seminal moments actually in the liberal constitutional order, when Chief Justice Marshall, who established this notion of judicial review, issued his opinion that President Andrew Jackson disagreed with, and Jackson said, Marshall has issued his opinion, now let him enforce it. However, Justice Marshall's opinion ultimately was enforced in that case because the story of the United States is the story of the rule of law. Ours is a government of laws, not of men. What Donald J. Trump has done today is contrary to the most fundamental law of the United States of America, and that is our Constitution. And the Emoluments Clause is no minor feature of the Constitution. It was one of the most fundamental, if not the most fundamental concerns of the framers of the Constitution and the founders of our country, that a president would come into office and would be getting emoluments, would be getting foreign government benefits, payments, other things of value from foreign sovereigns or their agents, and that his decisions would be distorted and bent by that, that the instead of deciding as he makes his appointments, as he does his domestic policy, his foreign policy, what's in the best interests of the United States, consciously or unconsciously, he would be influenced by these enormous things of value that the Trump Organization collects around the world and in the United States from foreign governments. And by the way, there's significant issues with states and other domestic sovereigns making payments in the United States too. So these conflicts of interest are core. I do not believe that any of the branches of government are going to stand for it. I don't think the judicial branch will stand for it. Ultimately, the legislative branch won't. The prosecutorial authorities are going to be all over the first scandal in the president's own executive branch, the FBI, career prosecutors, state attorneys general will also be on top of this and many others. Forgive me, Eric, it's something I feel very passionately about.
Can I add to that, just in defense of the president-elect, that I do not believe at this point, as of today, he is violated the law unless he or someone working for his campaign has cooperated with the Russians in connection with espionage. Of course, that would violate our laws. It would be a very serious offense. And all of that, of course, needs to be investigated by the House and Senate Intelligence Committees to find out who's been doing that and who's been engaging in espionage in the United States with the Russians. But putting that aside, I see that the president-elect, he has 9 days to fix this problem. The plan we heard today does not comply with the law. He is not in violation of the law as of today, but he has 9 days to fix it. And these emoluments, these payments from foreign governments, have to be out of the Trump business empire on January 20th, or he will be in violation of the law. And as I say, it is not an obscure provision of the Constitution. It was intended to preserve the independence of the United States from foreign powers and foreign powers meddling in our political system. And that's exactly what we see has been going on in 2016, going into 2017. And he has an obligation to protect the United States from that kind of thing.
Richard, since even the president-elect praised the New York Times at his press conference today, I can see that we've filibustered, at least I have, instead of answering Mr. Lipton's question. So go ahead. You can ask it again. I'll try to do better.
What jurisdiction does the OGE have to enforce this opinion? And what's the recourse if President-elect Trump or President Trump ignores it?
OGE is not an enforcement agency. However, there are a series, if the president-elect, for example, needs any certificates of divestiture, if he's going to argue that some of the moves he's making today are tax, should benefit from the tax exemption when you make a divestiture in order to deal with a conflict, I think that OGE is going to have to sign on to those type of things. OGE is not, Eric, it's a good question, they are not the enforcement authority. But they do have a duty, and I thought it was quite remarkable that Director Schaub was willing to step up and share his honest opinion. He is not a partisan. And I think it's quite remarkable that he's spoken out. I'll amend my earlier answer by saying those other authorities will then need to move. I would imagine his opinion will be of some importance to some of those other authorities. He has limited enforcement power.
I'll add that the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution is enforced principally by the United States House of Representatives in the case of serious violations by an official who is impeachable by the House. The bribery and gratuity statutes are, of course, enforced by the Department of Justice, and these are career prosecutors in the Department of Justice, and I am confident that they would prosecute any and all violations of the bribery and gratuity statutes regardless of who the violator is or where the evidence might lead. So there are enforcement mechanisms in place, and I have full confidence in them.
Kent, may I take one question? Is there anybody else here who has a question? All right, I'm going to take one question from Twitter, and then we're going to end. We have a stop of 4:45, and we're already a little over. Payson, Melissa Payson asks, the problem is that Mr. Trump is not ethical and believes he's above the law. Unfortunately, he seems to get away with it. Why? Melissa, I can't agree with your assessment. I saw one poll today that had Mr. Trump in the high 30s, which would, in his one public opinion poll, which is more than 20 points below where President Obama was at this point in the traditional honeymoon period of a transition. And we must remember that Mr. Trump won fewer votes than his opponent, and this is anything but a mandate. And so we've seen two very substantial victories for ethics, although they're preliminary skirmishes, with a public outcry last week about the closing of the Office of Government Ethics. I was proud to speak out bipartisan with Professor Painter to push back on that overnight holiday weekend sneak attack on the Office of Congressional Ethics, pardon me, the House Ethics Overseer, and it failed. And just this week, there was an outcry, and Mitch McConnell even went on the morning shows on Sunday and said the Democrats need to start complaining about all these hearings. They need to grow up. And we found a letter, I believe I was one of the first to tweet it out, from Mitch McConnell demanding no hearings in 2009 for President Obama's nominees unless there was a full ethics disclosure 278 agreement and ethics package before the hearing. Lo and behold, again, the power of bipartisanship. Professor Painter and I and many others spoke out in a bipartisan way about having these hearings. And four hearings were postponed this week where these materials were not provided. So I do believe that public outcry can make a difference, and the other branches of the federal government and the states will step up to fill the enforcement responsibilities that the New York Times was asking about. I'll give Richard the last word.
I just want to supplement the answer here. This is not a political question. I don't care if he had won 99% of the vote. That's irrelevant in my view. The Constitution is the Constitution. It's binding upon the president, as it is on the members of Congress and everyone else. Nobody is above the law. This is not a political question. Congress has a job to do. Of course, there could be a political response. If Congress fails to conduct proper oversight over the executive branch, that is not going to bode well for one party that controls both the legislature and the presidency. We're going to see over the next 2 years if having one party in control of both branches of government works, whether we're going to get meaningful oversight from the House and from the Senate, or whether they're just going to spend the next 2 years still sorting through Hillary Clinton's email while all sorts of stuff goes on that shouldn't be going on. So we'll see how it works. But the law is the law, regardless of how many votes anybody got. Donald Trump will be president, but he's going to have to comply with the law. He's not above the law. And I very much hope that he will realize that and that he can be an effective president.
Okay. I want to thank everybody for participating here in person. I want to thank the director of OGE, Walt Schaub, my colleague, Republican ethics expert Richard Painter, and I want to thank all of you who joined us on the internet for this Brookings Governance Studies press conference on President-elect Donald J. Trump's plan to deal with his conflicts. Thank you very much.